Part one, Richard. Richard was my friend. He was newly ordained. He was a former cop. He was energetic and creative. He loved music and motorcycles. He spent several years in congregations that needed transformation, congregations that needed a new vision, congregations that needed to be able to imagine a future or embrace death. That kind of ministry is hard work. Richard worked hard. He used to go to the jazz clubs after hours, hang out with the musicians, play a set or two with them when he was invited, talk theology or whatever, invite them to worship, and sometimes they came. He wished his congregations were as alive and creative as the jazz clubs, as rich with soul. It took something out of Richard, this work of congregation transformation. It often does. Richard crashed in a small town in Indiana, leaving ministry in a most undignified way for a life that he could not yet name. He went to bartending school. He moved his family to Florida. And when he got there, with no bartending jobs available, he got a minimum wage job as an outreach worker in the homeless community. Being an outreach worker among homeless people is also hard work. Richard worked hard at it. He was an advocate, an ally. He wrote treatises, told stories, made the news, made friends. But this hard work also takes something out of you. Richard used to say, if you can't do something productive, do something dramatic. But dramatic isn't always helpful, and productive can be elusive. Richard crashed in Florida, this time on a motorcycle. He died in his early 40s, still wondering what the future may hold. Part two, Danny. Danny was the boyfriend of my best friend back when we were too young to appreciate what either of those things really meant. They met at church. Danny liked her a lot. He said he loved her. She believed him, loved him back. She was devoted to church. Danny was devoted to getting her attention. Danny had an experience at her church that he called being saved. He felt the Spirit of God crash down on him, call him to something new. He said yes to that, wanted something new. But their church had expectations about what saved behavior looked like. A lot of churches do. Danny backslid. Movies, pool halls, swearing. Eventually, he was saved again and slid backwards again. I figured back then that Danny was trying to have both his very familiar life and his very religious girlfriend. But maybe I misunderstood back then. Maybe what Danny was really learning and showing me was how God tends to grab hold of us and then throw us right back in the same water. Sort of a spiritual catch and release program. Experiences of God don't always take us somewhere new, but often right back to where we came from. Back to our lives, back to our communities. With a new vision, we hope, a new attitude, a new approach, but our old lives. It is often the case. Part three, George. I met George just recently, a young man who experienced debilitating anxiety about people and new things and life in general, a constant fear that the world was going to crash in on him. Somehow he found his way to a church community center, and through the center he found a life he could embrace. George became involved in the community garden. Then he became a master gardener. For George, salvation looked an awful lot like being able to get off the bus and keep breathing and do something despite the fear. Part four, Sandra, Dave, Lon, and all the rest. This week I was in Los Angeles meeting with Sandra, Dave, Lon, and all the rest, directors of mission centers from across the country. It's our yearly gathering to share ideas and offer support, to plot and scheme ways to shake up the church. Many of you remember that last year, about this time, I traveled to South Texas to meet with this group. And I was struck this year by the theme of transition that emerged as we shared stories and updates. One director is intending retirement and making a succession plan. Another has taken a second job because mission centers don't always pay enough to support a family. Another, a center for older people, is trying to keep up with changes in how we approach long-term care in America. And one, a quite old and historic center, has sold all of its property in order to approach its mission in a new way. I'm not sure I know where all of this is going, which is sort of my point today. We don't always know what's coming down the road. It's just part of being human, living this life. So there's part five, Elisha. Elisha was Elijah's student, followed him around, hoping to be like him. Heck, in just today's story alone, he follows Elijah from Gilgal to Bethel and then to Jericho and Jordan in what one writer called Elijah's retirement victory lap. At each stop, Elisha pledges not to leave him, and each time he is taunted by older, more mature prophets who thought he was behaving a little bit like somebody's kid brother wanting to do big kid things. Each time he offers to them a very adult response. He says, "Shut up." In the end, Elisha saw something, a vision, a display of power and the grandeur of God. He was so moved by it that he tore his clothing in half, the clothing that he was wearing. Not a small gesture when we considered that he probably didn't have a change of clothes. But then the next thing that he did, not part of our reading today, was this. He picked up the mantle of Elijah, the symbol of the prophetic office, and he went and he stood back on the banks of the Jordan River. And he struck the water, and he made the waters part. Just like Elijah had a few days before, just like Moses did generations before in the Red Sea. And then he walked across it. Just like that. Elijah disappears and Elisha starts doing miraculous Elijah-like things. And in fact, if you keep reading, you'll see a few verses later, some people claim to him that the city's water supply is tainted. It's foul. It's not fit for drinking. And he does a miraculous purification. And then he encounters some kids who call him names and make fun of the fact that he's bald. And he does miraculous, dramatic things and still has to deal with bullies. But this time, instead of saying, "Shut up," now he's got power, you know. Now he calls in bears from the woods to maul the children. Very mature, Elisha, very mature. And part six, Peter. Peter went up the mountain. Peter and the others were not always quick to grasp the significance of Jesus' words or actions. They sometimes had to be corrected by Jesus, called down for their focus on the wrong things or their failure to get it. So here they are on this mountain where Jesus is suddenly, amazingly, unexpectedly revealed to them in a new way and standing in the company of Elijah and Moses, revered prophet and heroic teacher. Peter is speechless, but not nearly long enough. And he manages to ask Jesus if they should go ahead and make a camp and plan to stay a while. Maybe Peter wants to capture a feeling, like most of us at any major event in our lives, church camp or first kiss or the day you got engaged or graduated from something. Let's just make this moment last forever. Maybe. Or maybe he wants to hide. Maybe he wants a tent so he can hide from what's going on around him. Maybe Peter realizes this is something that's going to rock his world, and he'd rather not have his world rocked quite yet. Not again. Either way, Jesus says no. And down the mountain they go, back to life, but with a very different outlook. I've never had a theophany like that, a visual experience of God's glory. I've never seen God take anyone to heaven or rain fire or transfigure anybody. My life is just filled with people doing the best they can despite the odds. George and Richard and Danny and Sandra and Dave and Lon and all the rest. And so I wonder, how do you go back to work on Monday if you've had an experience like that over the weekend? How do you go back to the same old desk or assembly line or cubicle or route or classroom? How do you wake up over coffee the next day or sit in traffic or care for a chronic patient or deal with a customer buying mundane, ridiculous things, really? This is what you're spending your money on when this just happened to me over the weekend? On the other hand, I also wonder how you keep going to church on Sundays if you have not had an experience like that. How do we gather week after week after week to celebrate God's mystery and magnificence and respond to God's call and care if we have never seen such a thing as a chariot of fire or a dazzling display of transfiguration? How do you, just one more day, get off the bus and head to the garden? Picking up the mantle is an act of faith. Showing up is an act of faith. Yesterday, I was driving the final leg of my trip back to Flint. I drove to Louisville, flew to California, flew back to Louisville, drove back to Flint. And I was driving back in frigid, cold, whiteout conditions. And as I drove, thinking, man, people better show up for worship if I write a sermon. As I drove, it's the big things, really. As I drove, I got a text message with a photo attached. Woodsiders, downtown on Saginaw Street, carrying the flag of humanity. Bundled to their eyebrows, with the flag whipping in the wind. And I thought to myself how very dedicated they were to be there in the cold, standing with Flint residents who have no water, who cannot afford water, standing in the cold as an act of defiant faith, carrying this particular mantle of Elijah, which was also the mantle of Franklin Elmer, which has also been the mantle of this congregation for so many generations. For so many decades, the mantle of Elijah, the mantle of Elisha, of Woodside, is the prophet's word to a hurting world, God's word of righteous transformation, a mantle of water and housing and food and community, a mantle of enough and dignity, of hope and vision and restoration, a proclamation that faith is about showing up, that faith is about declaring a new word on God's behalf and demanding a new approach. Faith is about the creativity and vision and desire for something else. It's about standing with others, maybe others whom you have never met, inviting renewal and letting go of the past, embracing a future you can't yet see, a future we may only prepare for those who follow without actually experiencing it ourselves. Faith is precisely in the daily going on. But things get in our way. Maybe like Peter, we are afraid of what may change, of what may be extracted from us. Or we want a moment we can capture, much like we would capture a new profile photo for our Facebook page. Maybe we're stymied by the taunts of those who don't see what we see or can't imagine what we are trying to imagine, what God is inviting us to imagine. Maybe our own fears or demons or anxieties or inadequacies or schedules or to-do lists are in our way. We have responsibilities after all, children and elderly parents and jobs and mortgages and sidewalks to shovel and groceries to put away. Maybe we like our lives, like our church the way it is, like our routine. Picking up the mantle suggests a responsibility that we are not yet ready to accept, or there's just no time. Maybe going down the mountain just requires too much. Heck, maybe going up the mountain wasn't really our idea in the first place. Maybe we just don't see it after all, whatever it is, and haven't felt God's presence in a very long time. Maybe all of this just feels a little too supernatural and hard to embrace. Not the quiet, steady, manageable God we've come to know and love and prefer. Liturgically, in terms of our worship, that is, we are in transition from Epiphany to Lent. Jesus comes down the mountain and begins a long trek to Jerusalem where he will be killed. We move from this season of light and seeing and God's grandeur to a season of reflection and return and reconsideration of our relationship with God and Christ, a season of death that makes way for a season of resurrection. So I invite us today to pause and consider what those things might be, what demons or fears or vices or distractions may be stunting or derailing our relationship with God, our full humanness, our ability to be in community and embrace an unknown future. This Wednesday, we will mark our foreheads with ash and reflect on our own impermanence in the world. The ashes are the dust of last year's Palm Sunday parade, but also the ashes of our fears and demons. So today, I invite us to write down whatever it is, write it down and toss it into a fire of renewal, part of our offering to God. Elisha tore his clothing in an act of mourning, offered everything that he had for the sake of what was possible. So today we offer not only our gifts of money for the church's mission, but our willingness to reduce to ash the things that hold us back. Our congregation is on a journey, invited by God to what we cannot yet know, a journey that may bring us to a new place or plant us renewed in the very same place, a journey that will certainly require something of us and will also take something from us. A journey through death to life, a journey that begins with fire.